Eugenics, the pseudoscience of improving humanity by breeding out so-called undesirable traits, was practiced in the United States before and after Adolf Hitler used it to rationalize the mass genocide of Jews and other ethnic and religious groups. In her film called The State of Eugenics, Dawn Sinclair Shapiro shines a light on America's shameful history with eugenics, focusing on North Carolina's 50-year-long forced sterilization program, interviewing victims, journalists, activists, and lawmakers. It airs at 9 p.m. this coming Sunday on WLIW's The World Channel, as well as other PBS stations, and I'm very pleased it has brought Dawn Sinclair Shapiro to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
You've been a producer for CBS, MSNBC, Dateline, and Chicago Public Radio. Did you hear this story while you were doing that work?
No. In the past 8 years, I've been doing independent documentary, and it was in the summer of 2011 when I heard the hearings from survivors in North Carolina that went viral, and I wasn't quite sure what I was hearing. And that's what made me dig and dig and get to this film 5 years later.
When was the so-called science of eugenics developed?
So it goes back, I mean, it's a century ago. At the turn of the last century, eugenics made its way across the pond.
From England.
From the UK. And it comes here. Really, it takes a hold in 1910. You get the Eugenics Record Board Office in Long Island. And they're kind of working on two tracks. They're working in the area of trying to come with a legal framework to create a program, essentially negative eugenics, to forcibly sterilize people. On the other side, they're also working on marriage laws. They're working on anti-immigration laws, using the pseudoscience of eugenics to try and bolster those efforts. And you get the Buck v. Bell case in 1927, which is sort of the culmination of that propaganda effort.
Before we get to Buck v. Bell, many states adopted these programs. Why did you choose to focus on North Carolina?
So North Carolina is widely regarded as one of the most egregious, and it was also the only state in 2011 that was trying to recognize this and to bring about a compensation program. So there was something current to follow that kind of put us in the middle of the story.
Do we know why it took North Carolina so much longer to disband its eugenics program than other states?
Partly because the program, after World War II, as you mentioned in your lead, it continues to get underwritten at the state level every 2 years. It's in the budget. The physicians are paid. The social workers are underwritten to go throughout their client base and to petition for their clients to be sterilized. The other part that happens that's unique in North Carolina is there's this public-private partnership that happens after World War II, so that more individual, wealthy citizens in North Carolina, particularly in the Winston-Salem area, join forces with the state welfare agencies to promote the program and to train and to essentially kind of underwrite it over the next few decades.
North Carolina has some of the most prestigious universities in America. What kind of academic scholarship was there on the topic of eugenics in the United States?
So Wake Forest, it's interesting, we had a screening there last week, and that came up a lot about the role of Wake Forest, which is a great university, does really good work, and out of this created one of the more rigorous bioethics programs. So we examined it from that perspective, both in terms of their relationship back in the day. And before World War II, again, you have to look at it, you do sort of have to kind of use that as your dividing line. After World War II, Wake Forest was still continuing to do surgeries, not only rubber stampings that were approved at the state North Carolina Eugenics Board level, but allowing programs and physicians on their own to practice this on people that they believed should not be procreating. And the university identified its role. It apologized for it. And it is that play of, you know, the physician, these were multiple agencies that were involved, people on the, it was a local effort from the sheriff knocking on your door to the physicians performing the surgeries to the social workers harassing and coercing, but it was all legal.
Well, who determined whether somebody should be, was it mostly sterilized?
Basically, it was a petition process, and the people who were certified to submit a petition for someone to be sterilized are social workers, physicians, sheriffs, county workers, and it fell primarily in the social worker and the physicians in North Carolina. They would send a petition to the North Carolina Eugenics Board, which was a body that met monthly, and it was made up of 5 members, and it was the head of the state agencies at the time. And that monthly meeting would listen to a summary of each case, and in the rare case, the rare opportunity that someone got to petition to say, I don't want the surgery, I don't want it for my daughter, most of those petitions were rubber stamped, and the surgeries often happened in less than a year.
And I'm assuming that in the case of North Carolina, some people have perceived a racial bias.
Oh, there's clearly, the scholars agree, there's a racial bent to the program. I was on a panel with...
In just North Carolina, or would it have been in northern states as well?
You know,
because this was all across the country.
I think because I've examined the primary sources and the interviews in North Carolina really show this is a pushback on the early civil rights movement and up and through the 60s. And there are all sorts of bends that the program takes. If you think of sterilization, it kind of becomes a tool, if you will, of people who were calling themselves eugenicists before World War II. And after that, you couldn't use the word eugenics, but they were still employing the tool of sterilization to prevent people who they didn't want more of to have children.
We're talking to Don Sinclair Shapiro, who is both director and producer of a documentary called The State of Eugenics. You mentioned the 1927 Supreme Court decision, Buck v. Bell, an 8-1 decision, only one dissent. And the decision was written by Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr., considered by many people to be one of the greatest justices in the history of the Supreme Court. He decided that a state statute permitting compulsory sterilization of the unfit, including the intellectually disabled, for the protection and health of the state, did not violate the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. And he famously said, 3 generations of imbeciles is enough.
Well, it's a part of the film where we place it so that people can kind of marinate on that a little bit and try and understand where that language and verbiage comes from. And so we unpack it a little to also point out that words like imbecile and moron were actually medically used terms up until the 50s. So if we look at those words for their time, today we all cringe and kind of sit back when we hear it. But the other part in the decision, and in the opinion, I should say, is that he equates it to the public health movement of mandatory vaccination. And that was very much at play at the same time eugenics was coming about. So you had this huge progressive movement for public health that was bettering lives and saving people. And at the same time, eugenics is coming about, and people like Holmes were believing that these two could cross bridge and be good for America.
They were basing it on IQ tests or something else?
That was one of the criteria in North Carolina. They take on, so each state, the more than 30 states passed eugenic sterilization statutes. And in North Carolina, they used a criteria of epilepsy and an IQ, essentially, and mental, a term called feeble-mindedness. And so the IQ test, if you had below a 70 or below, and they had an official, but kind of was employed by if a social worker thought that your IQ was low, they would just write down any number.
This is such a sensitive topic. I'd imagine that many of the people who were, should we use the word victims?
Well, I use the word survivors after spending time with
survivors,
these people.
Are they open about what happened to them?
Such a spectrum. I had the great privilege to be in their homes and in their lives. And you can see in the film, they're men and women. They're black and white. And they all have this amazing ability, you know, as a filmmaker, interviewing people about something and something so traumatic that happened decades ago. They all 3 of the people in our film do something kind of miraculous. They put us back in time. They were adolescents. And one was 18.
So. And were they told what was being done to them? Because in Los Angeles, there was a program in which non-English speakers were given hysterectomies after they produced their first child. And they were told that they were being sterilized, which they thought meant there was kind of a clean thing going on there.
Exactly. Yes. There was all sorts of trickery employed, and particularly at the LA County, that your hospital you're speaking of. Absolutely. You see that same trickery in North Carolina, and they would often say, "Oh, this is reversible." You know, especially for women, when you say, "I'm going to tie your tubes," there was this sort of suggestion, and then you can have them untied when you're ready.
What about the doctors who performed these procedures? Didn't any of them wonder whether it went against the Hippocratic Oath?
At a certain point in the records, you do see a pushback from physicians, and they are, you're talking more in the period when we get to informed consent. You're getting to the racial bent that North Carolina takes, and the doctors started to push back more on the eugenics board.
What about the people who were brought into the program? Did any of them resist? Were they able to prevent it from happening?
There is a process that you could have a hearing. The hearings are primarily, if you read some of the transcripts from the board records, they are, well, we're going to have the Purdue process. We have to let them come in and have their hearing, but they would still, most of those cases were still completed with sterilization.
Are there health effects as a result in some cases?
Sure. There's a wide array. And again, a lot of these surgeries were particularly crude because sometimes it was, you'd look at a physician and there were records to show he was trying to get in, you know, a half a dozen in a morning. The two women in our film talk at great length, and having had been privy to some of their medical discussions that they shared with me, yes, there were all sorts of complications.
I was surprised to see the father of one of our most beloved broadcasters, Charles Kuralt, involved in this story. Who was Wallace Kuralt, and wasn't he seen as a progressive?
He was, and he was one of the great progressives in many ways. He brought all sorts of wonderful family enhancements to people who were poor in North Carolina. He was one of the thought leaders of the time. He saw this as a way to bring contraception essentially to poor people in his district and around the state, who at that time, until you get to the early 60s, there wasn't that much reliable contraception available. And he worked in, you know, the way that a welfare director of Mecklenburg County had to work. He had to keep the state and local commissioners happy, and they had to underwrite the program. And he had to show them what they wanted to hear, which was that you would have fewer poor people having children, and that's going to help save taxpayer dollars.
Was this well known? Because an important part of the story is that the Winston-Salem Press reported on it.
No, the records were sealed, and it wasn't until a historian, Johanna Schoen, goes into the archive while researching at Chapel Hill the birth control program in North Carolina, which ironically was the first public birth control program in the country. It was there where an archivist hands her these rolls of film because he didn't want to live with the burden anymore, and he felt someone needed to know about it.
And then there's the ACLU Reproductive Freedom Project. What was their involvement in this program?
So Brenda Feigen and Justice Ginsburg co-found the Reproductive Freedom Project, and some of their earlier cases are the sterilization abuse. At the same time, they're taking on cases, which is the right not to procreate, the abortion and contraception, and then sterilization. They saw it as a spectrum of rights.
What happened in North Carolina after an assembly member, Larry Womble, took up the cause?
Larry Womble, it takes him almost a decade. As soon as the Winston-Salem series breaks, which we show in the film in 2002, it takes him years to even get any traction in the General Assembly. And in 2010, you see a turnover in North Carolina for the first time in 100 years to a Republican General Assembly. And it is the Speaker of the House, Tom Tillis, who had been educated by Larry Womble during their shared time in the House, and he goes to Larry and says, "I want to take this up."
Tom Tillis, who is now senator from North Carolina. But is it important that Tom Tillis is a Republican and Womble was a Democrat in getting the legislation enacted?
I think it shows...
Because didn't Tillis get a lot of pushback from his fellow Republicans?
He did. I heard the phrase, isn't this do-gooder liberalism? And you would hear him and some of his caucus members who were out trying to advocate for compensation that this was a solid conservative libertarian issue. This was essentially, this is the ultimate property right, you would hear them say. And Larry Womble had been more of your social justice kind of crusading legislator, and together they made a great team. I think ultimately you need the leadership of the speakership, and he brought that to it and got it done.
There's a whole issue of compensation for the survivors of these programs. Has anything happened?
So North Carolina is the first state to put into their 2013 budget a $10 million pie for sterilization victims to apply for. Following that, Virginia passed a statute that gave an outright dollar amount, and now there is a push towards California to look at its history and to consider maybe the roadmap that was created in North Carolina could be a pathway for them.
How much did these people who have been sterilized against their will wind up receiving?
The third payment is scheduled sometime in 2017, and it'll be roughly a total payment of between $40,000 and $50,000 each.
So not a lot.
If you have to think
about it. If you want to have a child.
Right. And you want to say, how much would you sell your reproductive right for?
A listener called who used to work in population research in the 1970s, he found that where 40% of the women in Puerto Rico of childbearing age had been sterilized.
There's a global element to sterilization abuse, both the Puerto Rico back through the 80s, but also today. And you can look at the one-child policy in China, or you can look in India, too.
Some of the most emotional footage in your film is an interview with a woman named Niall Ruth Cox. Who is she?
She's really the heroine in the film, and she's the woman who is brave enough to bring her case to the ACLU. And she is in 1973, she is joined at an ACLU press conference by Eleanor Holmes Norton, by Gloria Steinem. And you see in the film how she has to stand up to what the North Carolina Eugenics Board deemed her unfit and not deemed worthy to have children. And she really stops. She's the only, without her case, the North Carolina Eugenics Board would have continued sterilizing people that year. And she dismantles the board with that case. She doesn't get compensation, but she does shut down the Eugenics Board.
Do you think that this will make the history books?
It should. And some of the people that we bring up in the film need to have their place, I believe, as well. Brenda Feigen and the work she did in anti-discrimination at the ACLU Reproductive Freedom Project and onwards. Niall as a heroine in how brave she had to be to confront these perpetrators. And I think there's an opportunity to kind of holistically look at these issues of reproductive freedom or reproductive rights, reproductive justice in this day and age so that we can understand this right to procreate is equally as important.
And when you've shown this film, your film, in North Carolina, what's been the response?
That was one of our great screenings, and the response was tears, laughter, applause. We have to keep bringing these histories to light, and we need to do it in a factual way, and we need to continue connecting dots so that we can start from the same playing field, the same set of facts when we want to go out and learn from our histories.
I mentioned that it will be broadcast this coming Sunday on WLIW's World Channel. Do you know any other stations?
Oh, sure. You can go to our website, The State of Eugenics. It will be airing nationwide on public TV, and the launch is this Sunday, and there will be multiple screenings. And then it will be available online at pbs.org, Real South, February 1st.
And there will be a screening and a panel discussion tomorrow from 12:30 to 2:15 p.m. at Fordham University Center Lowenstein Building at 113 West 60th Street. That's on the 12th floor in the conference room. Tickets are free, but they must be reserved. So we have put a link to it on our show page at wnyc.org/lopate. My great thanks to Dawn Sinclair Shapiro, who both directed and produced The State of Eugenics, for being on our show today. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.